Members, please have a seat. I call this meeting of Human Services Finance Committee to order. The first order of business is to approve the minutes for March 7, 2024. Vice Chair Barnard, do you want to move the approval for the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to move the minutes.
Vice Chair Barnard moves the approval of minutes for March 7, 2024. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes for March 7, 2024 is now adopted. The first bill before us today is House File 4514. Chair Joachim, I will move your bill to be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for a prompt start. This is, I need to model your example. Thank you, members, for having this bill up today. Minnesota is facing an epidemic mental health crisis across all sectors of our society. Our short-term crisis solutions are failing to meet the needs of Minnesotans, and our structures that are in place are currently unable to respond in a timely manner or support a successful recovery once it starts. But I know I don't have to tell this committee that because you hear about it all the time. This bill provides some solutions that will provide another tool to aid in the recovery of Minnesotans who are struggling. The tool is expanding the clubhouse community model across the state. In House File 4514, we ask for one-time funding for DHS to help a covered benefit under medical assistance for integrated health services, and a one-time funding to establish a demonstration project to develop and evaluate a model of care in at least three sites to aid in developing a covered benefit in Minnesota. In my own community of Hopkins, I've watched this community clubhouse model be very successful. Vail Place has this model and has served the West Metro region for 41 years. Vail Place expanded this model with a clubhouse in Minneapolis as well. And Vail Place helps adults living with mental illness make recovery not only in a sustainable way, but in an affordable and efficient way. Through greater social connections and a community rooted in the healing impacts of working together and belonging, clubhouse really makes recovery stick. Vail Place pairs single point access to housing, employment, health and wellness, and other critical community resources with a place to build community among their peers. The clubhouse model helps to remove isolation, provide educational opportunities, job training, and a chance to build necessary skills to thrive in the community outside the walls of the clubhouse. But I don't want you to take my word for it. I have folks here from the Hopkins and Ramsey, Minneapolis Vail Place sites to share their experiences. So, Mr. Chair, I'll let you call the testifiers up.
Thank you so much. The first testifier is Chad Bostrom. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Chad Bolstrom, and I'm the Director of Clubhouse Programming and Public Policy at Vail Place. I want to say good afternoon, and thank you, Chair Noir, and committee members, administrative staff, and Representative Joachim. As I mentioned, I'm from Vail Place. It's my privilege to join you today with my colleague, Margaret Humphrey, on behalf of Vail Place and the Minnesota Clubhouse Coalition, made up of partners across Greater Minnesota in support of House File 4514. As Representative Joachim identified in her statement and the one-page handout from Clubhouse International that we shared with you and likely in your daily witness in the world around us, we are in the midst of a mental health crisis. The wide-ranging impacts of mental illness on our community is pervasive, costly on both human and financial levels, and significantly disruptive to the health and success of our society. The need for mental health support has never been greater. As both a clinician and a clubhouse staff, I've witnessed and worked with people living with mental illness for nearly 20 years. And seeing the struggles and exceptional strengths of those that I've served firsthand, working with them to support their recovery and help to identify how to improve the possibility of long-term health and a higher quality of life. I began this work as a counselor in a large public hospital intensive day treatment program where I help people transition from acute mental health crises to stabilization. I was consistently confronted with the challenge of what happened when these more intensive, costly treatments ended. I saw how the cliff-like drop-off of support after intensive treatment undermined the recovery of those I was working with, often contributing to the revolving door of treatment created through our attempts to resolve severe and persistent illness through short-term, acute, and crisis-based solutions. Imagine for a moment if we used 3-month course of insulin to manage chronic diabetes and expected that those served were cured after the treatment. This recognition of the long-term needs of those who are served led me to look at alternatives. It led me to Vail Place, and it led me to the clubhouse model. Vail Place began 43 years ago with a small group of family members, clinicians, and a Minnesota medical director named Dr. Vail, championing the cause of client-centered, community-based interventions focused on prevention and long-term recovery by opening Minnesota's first clubhouse in Hopkins off of Main Street in 1981. For over 40 years, Vail Place has provided clubhouse services and has helped to grow the understanding and knowledge of the clubhouse model across the state of Minnesota, while also evolving and growing in the direction and needs of our membership, developing additional supports and care that members around us had identified as being most important and supportive of cementing their success. Like the world around us, Vail Place has also faced the need to evolve its leadership and focus on those communities traditionally underserved by traditional mental health services, including the hiring of our first Native American executive director, Karina Forrest Perkins, who's here with us today, who's helped us to champion finding solutions that serve all populations, especially those who have been historically and presently marginalized. The clubhouse model is a widely accepted evidence-based practice replicated in over 350 clubhouses in 34 countries around the world. And the model has developed and improved for over 70 years through the co-creation of folks just like us, colleagues working together to identify solutions that work within the communities to make the success and healing made through that community possible. While we are not a treatment or a technique, but rather a community-based intervention focused on working together side by side, like Margaret and I are doing here today, to both support our membership when there are moments of difficulty, setbacks, and inevitably those gaps that are still evident in our partially built mental health system that lead to crisis, or in those moments when, like today, we're supporting each other in our success and our strengths, providing a space for folks living with mental illness to be both well and thriving across the lifespan is unique to this model of care. The clubhouse model is widely accepted evidence-based practice in the state of Minnesota and across the country, and the evidence base is increasing daily, with research supporting its greater efficacy and cost savings being demonstrated worldwide. But beyond all that, the clubhouse is a place of hope, when hope for people, for those people most in need of it, is increasingly scarce. The clubhouse is a culturally responsive community working together to create a space of healing, identifying solutions embedded in the community where they exist, and focusing on providing a voice for those that we serve to continue to both improve and create routes like the one today for bringing their voice into an arena for finding solutions. The clubhouse creates a space that is safe, welcoming, and supportive of recovery across all differences of identity, opinion, or belief system. From my experience, mental illness makes no differentiation based on these differences, nor should our solutions. We are the ounce of prevention that helps to reduce the need for the pound of cure. In a time when the cure of crisis response is becoming increasingly taxed, delayed, and unavailable, the preventative approach offered by the clubhouse isn't just a good idea, it's essential to our mental health system ability to respond to these crises. We are neither alone nor the leader in this to clubhouse as a solution for the country, as many states, like Minnesota, have already embraced the clubhouse model as a solution, as is highlighted by 28 other states around the union who already have a similar Medicaid funding mechanism in place, including Midwest colleagues in Michigan who have a clubhouse in every county. And are currently, there are over a half dozen states that are looking at legislative processes similar to this one today to find mechanisms for funding clubhouse, not just for the short term, but for as long as it's needed. I want to again thank you for the opportunity to discuss this critical need in our community and our uniquely well-matched proposed solution. I welcome and look forward to your questions at the end of our time. But before that, I'd like to take a moment to reintroduce my colleague, Margaret Humphrey, and have her share more about her experiences of the clubhouse and its impacts in her life.
Thank you so much. Margaret Humphrey, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairman Knorr, and committee members. My name is Margaret Humphrey, and I am speaking in favor of House File 4514. I am a Ramsey County resident and have been a member of the Vale Place Clubhouse for 10 years. You may look at me and say, she doesn't look mentally ill, but I assure you that I am. I live with major depression, anxiety, and PTSD. What you see today is a direct result of the Clubhouse program. You see, 10 years ago, I suffered a mental breakdown and went through treatment at a local public hospital. I successfully completed it and was discharged, but sadly realized that there is nothing in the community to keep me and myself and others stabilized. Isolating at home led to worsening of my symptoms, ruminating about my worries that could have led to a life of multiple hospitalizations, continued confusion with no concept of how to get well and stay well. Luckily, I was referred to the clubhouse. I opened the front door of the clubhouse and discovered kind, caring, invested staff, people like myself, working towards their own recovery and a community, a group of like-minded individuals all working towards getting better. This community is key to recovery. I repeat, community is key to the recovery. No other program stresses community like Vale Place. They include community in all programs, tasks, decision-making, and growth. Each person gets to identify and live their own recovery journey, and each person's recovery is unique. Some choose to go back to work, others return to education, and some people's recovery is just to make it to Vale Place every day. In my journey, I started washing dishes because that's all I thought I could do. Gradually, I moved into support and leadership roles, helping others walk the steps in their own recovery. This allowed me to develop more confidence in my leadership abilities, eventually leading me to serve on the agency's board of directors, attending an international clubhouse conference, and returning back to paid employment, which was one of my goals. I am now employed at Canvas Health as a certified peer support specialist working at the Anoka County Mobile Mental Health Crisis Unit, assisting people who are suicidal or overwhelmed. I've taken my support, kindness, and caring that I received from the clubhouse and now assist Anoka County's residents through a brief period of their recovery. I also serve on the NAMI Ramsey County Board of Directors and have joined the Vale Place Advisory Council in setting up the new Ramsey County Clubhouse that will open in April, just 4 weeks away, maybe five. We would love to have you join us for the grand opening. Thank you for your time and consideration. We appreciate it.
And thank you so much, Margaret Humphrey, for your testimony and also sharing your story with us. So thank you so much. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Welcome. Please come to the mic and introduce yourself and proceed.
Mark Hughes, and I'll be as brief as I can, but I got lots of things I can say because it's quite a story. Clubhouse. We're leading the way again in Minnesota. We have one that is here to help people. And then people like Margaret was just up here, and she's got a job now in helping other people at Canvas Health, and she's helped other people within the organization. We have found that this organization has strong administrative skills, and what's nice about it is we've shown leadership here in Minnesota because we've got six other states who are trying to put together legislative funding to try to make something like this to form the foundation. We already have it here. We're leading the way again. And mental health is so very important, whether it's this type of things that Clubhouse serves or you're dealing with Alzheimer's, anything like that. It's all a form of mental illness, and we all deal with it in some way, shape, or form every day. So I support this bill, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hughes. Anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Yoakam, thank you for bringing this. I thought I knew just about everything there was about helping folks with this kind of support needs, mental health, and I had not heard of Clubhouse before today. Representative Zalesnikar has one in her community as well. My question is more about, and maybe this is more of a director question, but I do want to thank Margaret for helping others now in your journey. The being a peer recovery specialist and what you're doing is really important for all of us, trying to reach more people, so thank you. But what supports the Clubhouse now? If if they're out there now, how are they funded currently?
Mr. Bolster.
Yes, so right now the clubhouses that Vail Place operates are currently funded through a combination of private and public giving. Privately, we do fundraising throughout the year, and in fact, many clubhouse members would say we're pretty constantly doing fundraising. On the public side, we receive part of the AMHI grant funding through the state that is awarded to the counties, and so that's part of how our funding has been secured. I will acknowledge that funding has been challenged in the last year as well, and so that's been part of the reason that we're here today talking about the Medicaid funding.
Representative.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to seeing a site, maybe in Hopkins or something, wherever. I just would really want to see this model and see what's happening and maybe see how this works, because this is pretty cool stuff. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And you're all welcome. We'd love to have you for lunch anytime.
Great. So there's an open invitation to the members. And so you should be able to take anyone else? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Yoakam. My question is around when you were talking about the indigenous-specific cultural healing, I'm really interested in hearing what some of those best practices are, what you're utilizing, what outcomes you've seen. I know when it comes to addressing mental health to the indigenous community, we really view it differently. We don't typically go to medications. We go back to culture quite a bit. So I don't know if you or if you have somebody that would be willing to come up and just briefly walk through what some of the differences in those are from maybe the general supports to our cultural healing practices.
Thank you for the question.
Mr. Balsam. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Karina Forrest Perkins. I'm the executive director for Vail Place. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And what I can tell you about that is that the decision making that happens in the club are on what happens that are wanted or needed by the members are brought forward with shared decision making. So whatever activities they want to bring forward, they're able to bring into that environment based on the community that they're within and the individuals and the desires that they want to see happen in that community. So if they want to have a specific cultural practice, if they want to have a drumming group, or if they want to have a ceremonial event, they are able to decide as a group to have that in the environment. And that is the difference, because they are the decisions that are in the mental health system are almost always, I know it's well-intentioned, but they're almost always hierarchical. Professionals and experts, and then the people being served. And that juxtaposition necessarily puts people in a subordinate way, in a subordinate manner. And it is disempowering when you're really trying to look at healing. In the clubhouse, the members of the clubhouse and the staff work side by side on all decision making, all activities. So if the environment has an indigenous population in that particular clubhouse that wants to have certain activities, they're able to bring those in. If it's a clubhouse that has a different cultural group that wants different activities, they're able to bring those in. So that's the difference, is that it is driven by the individuals that are served and supported by the model. It is not driven by the staff and what they want to see happen in the model.
Representative.
Thank you. I like the structure. Could you give us some examples, though, of what some of the groups have done around cultural healing in our state in these programs now?
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, what I can tell you is they have practiced drumming groups that they have initiated. They have had ceremonial events that they have initiated. They have had specific cultural groups that they have initiated, book clubs that they have initiated. But again, I want to stress that the clubhouse is it does not try to co-opt or take on specific healing strategies from any culture. It is about what the individual in the clubhouse wants to see happen. That will mean lots of community members with lots of multicultural desires that they want to experience together. So one of the things that we have done with the Department of Human Services, and this is new for us, I have been there now a year and a half. We have been around for 43 years. We contracted with the Department of Human Services to incorporate the class standards and cultural specificity into the clubhouse model. This is a new initiative that we are focusing on, and it is the model that we are embracing for any expansion into the rest of the state. So that's the best answer that I can give you. I would really love to have individuals who have experienced or initiated culturally specific activities to come speak to you themselves rather than me speak on their behalf, when I may not know a lot of the history of a lot of the individuals who have come to the clubhouse, many of whom have come for 35 years. So I don't have specific examples other than the ones that I gave you, but I would love to have you for a tour. I would also love to bring individuals that represent multiple cultural groups to talk with you and tell you directly what they've experienced.
Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who can answer this, but clubhouses did we say we have in Minnesota? I thought I heard.
Director.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, we have two clubhouses. One, the original site is in Hopkins. The second site is in Minneapolis. And we have a planned third site to be opened in Ramsey County.
Okay.
Vice Chairman.
Thank you for that. Mr. Chair, so we have three today, which we're primarily funding through sort of private-public partnership. I noticed in the letter from NAMI that it suggested that we have some issues with funding at Vail Place. Can you speak a little bit more to what has led to that and how this bill might help facilitate that particular location and help them to continue their mission?
Excellent question. I think that the counties have predominantly sustained the burden of funding Clubhouse in the state of Minnesota. They are routinely called upon to serve as a safety net and provide crisis response when it's needed. And when they feel strapped themselves, they will move away from early intervention and prevention models to crisis models, and that's what Hennepin did when they decided to defund our Minneapolis site in 2022. And so we have had to fundraise to backfill that gap in revenue and have done so.
Vice Chairman.
Thank you for that. I think, you know, certainly it's a shame that that happened, because I think we all agree that getting ahead of some of those issues can really help alleviate some of that pressure from that crisis situation. So I really appreciate this model, and I just wanted to say that I too am new to this particular model. Like Representative Baker, was blown away by the fact that this model exists, and moreover that you have, well, we were just talking now about different healing spaces, and one of the things that I've come to understand from folks I know and folks who have had challenges with mental health is there's always a real feeling of lack of control, of loss of control, that is really pervasive and difficult to overcome on their journey to recovery. So I really appreciated your conversation about having members be responsible for sort of helping to determine their path and their journey to find healing, and in essence, giving them back a level of control, and to really empower them on that journey. So I really appreciate that model, and I thank you for coming forward to talk about this, and certainly would be excited to tour the facility and get a better look at it. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnik.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I appreciate the clubhouse model, and I just wanted to clarify, the North Shore has a mental health group, and I just met with them last week about charter houses. And so the goal is to have one. So for Greater Minnesota, there hasn't been a charter house. It's there. So my intent is to have Northern Minnesota and Greater Minnesota have resources like this, because I think the thing that's very different about this model is the community relation that exists. And having served on the Aging Task Force and the EMS Task Force, for Greater Minnesota, issues are real and affecting people where they're aging. And having that community partnership, and we have 40% increased mental health since the isolation of the pandemic, and we need to change that course fast. And the best way to me is community models like this. And what I like about it is it takes in the culture of that community. In Silver Bay area and the North Shore, they might be fishing to heal. They might be, you know, making lefse. I don't know. There's a variety of things that could go on in camaraderie and community and healing, but I love the fact that it's a community focus to do that and to deal with outreach in an early stage instead of the end game. Because the other side is 70% of the ambulance calls are for non-emergency transportation and mental health. And we have no ability to deliver in Greater Minnesota for that. And so this is a very cost-effective way to do that. And I would love to be a pilot project for Northern Minnesota on something like this. And so to me, we have not had that. It's only been a metro suburb thing. And mental health doesn't know a geographic boundary. And we need to have these type of initiatives available for the people. So thank you.
Thank you. The next person is Representative Kwok. No. Oh. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. And it's actually really helpful that my colleague went first, because I was looking at 2.9 and it talks about located in rural Minnesota. And so that's not the same as Greater Minnesota. And so I wonder a little bit about that language and what that would mean, because rural is not the same thing as greater. So like Rochester and Duluth, for example, and Moorhead are not considered necessarily rural, but they are greater. And then given that it appears my colleague thinks this would be great in her community, I would agree, but there's only one Greater Minnesota site in the bill. And so I'm a little bit concerned that like the metro has this, we're going to add more here, and then the other 40% of the state gets one to share.
Director.
Mr. Chair, excellent question. What you're describing is this brief period of time for the Department of Human Services to build a Medicaid benefit for clubhouse activity. The hope is that once this Medicaid benefit is operationalized at DHS, that anyone in the state of Minnesota could operate a clubhouse. The urban site and the rural or Greater Minnesota site is something we initiated, saying we need to have a demonstration project so that we can understand what the unique challenges are of all populations in the state of Minnesota when we build this Medicaid benefit. And we believe that if we do not include Greater Minnesota in that composition as we're building the benefit, then we will miss what you want and need in your respective communities. So the Medicaid, so the period of time that we're talking about with resourcing the demonstration project is just to build the benefit. When the benefit is built, that would impact the entire state equitably.
Representative Hicks.
Chair, thank you. I would encourage the bill author maybe to think about other ways to gather input from Greater Minnesota too, because I think if you only have one site and it's in Duluth or it's in Moorhead or it's in Rochester, you're going to miss what the rest of us need. And so I just, there may be some opportunity to work together there if you're not opposed, Chair Joachim, to make sure that whatever, if we're really trying to figure out what is needed, I don't know that one Greater Minnesota site is going to get us those answers.
I have on the list.
Really quick question. Thank you, Chair. Did you discuss like the success rate of folks that go through your program and their success rate with their treatment?
I'll give it to Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And in the packet is, in your packets are some of the statistics, and I'm sure offline they could give you some more. I have a little bit in my closing, but yeah, evidence base is important to give you the evidence, right? So definitely can get you information.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, Chair Joachim. To your closing remarks.
Thank you. First, I want to thank you all for asking the questions and having this conversation. This is what committee processes are for, and I appreciate it. And like my testifiers have said, how much this means to be able to expand. Hopkins has had this for a while and have been trying to cobble together funding streams. They have their access points, and they finally expanded a few years ago into another building just across the parking lot where they've now built an outdoor space for people to gather too, where they have the building where all the services and the access point for the critical care is there, and then they have the clubhouse that the members help run. So those work in conjunction together, and it would be a great time, a great opportunity for you to see how that works. But just again, thank you. Clubhouse is a widely accepted evidence-based solution that not only saves lives but supports lasting recovery now into the future. It provides a system of support that helps avoid hospitalization and deep and crisis experiences. And it does this in an affordable and efficient way. For example, the cost for a member to attend each day of the year is equivalent to 1 3-day psychiatric hospitalization. So they could be in a clubhouse all year for the same amount it would cost for 3 days in psychiatric hospitalization. So this model has seen an 89% decrease in hospitalization through rapid access management and community building. So members, I would love for you to visit, and I would love for your support.
Thank you so much. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4514 be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. You are on your way, Chair Joachim, to Health and Health, Finance, and Policy. The next bill we have is House File 3939. Representative Thoran, welcome to the committee. I will move that House File 3939 be laid over. With that, please proceed with the introduction of the bill.
All right. Thank you so much, Chair and committee members, for taking the time to hear House File 3939 today. I'll keep my introduction brief. This bill is brought forward by ARM, which is a statewide association, trade association of residential service providers. This particular bill provides a time-limited license conversion opportunity for a small group of homes that are currently licensed as supportive living facilities or SLS facilities to convert to a CRS or community residential setting. This is a temporary exception as written that would be in place until June 30th, 2026. And I just want to note that it would impact a total of 14 homes across the state or 84 Minnesotans. So we're talking about a very unique, very specific group of folks here that this will affect. And I'd like to turn it over to Ken Bentz with ARM for further details.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Bentz. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. For the record, my name is Ken Bentz. I'm the Director of Research, Analysis, and Policy for ARM. From previous discussions over the last two sessions, you are likely familiar with community residential settings, or CRSs, which are typically group homes and are reimbursed through the Disability Waiver Rate System, or DWRS. You've also heard about intermediate care facilities, or ICFs, for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, which are not reimbursed through the DWRS. Whereas CRSs are licensed by the Department of Human Services, ICFs are a type of supervised living facility, or SLF, and are duly licensed by both the Departments of Human Services and Health. House File 3939 proposes to change an uncommon occurrence for homes that are classified as SLFs with a maximum capacity of 6 but are not ICFs and are instead supporting individuals that are receiving community residential services through one of the disability waivers and are paid through the DWRS. Because they are SLFs, these homes are required to be licensed by both the Departments of Human Services and Health, and there are 14 such homes around the state, as Representative Curran said. The proposal in front of you would allow for a time-limited license conversion, allowing only these 14 homes to permanently convert from an SLF to a CRS and maintaining their current license capacity. By allowing for this conversion, the individuals that live in these homes will have access to assistive technology for remote support, if they so desire, and can also have alone time, both things that are not allowed in SLFs. The conversion will also allow providers to work solely with the Department of Human Services as their licensing agency, eliminating the administrative burden of having to license through two agencies. In this bill, we are not proposing a change in capacity to any existing home, nor would this change in licensure add any cost to the waivers because the individual's rates would not change. Rather, we are simply proposing a change in the license type to open up options for the individuals living in 14 homes and to reduce an administrative burden for providers. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Benson, for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Baker.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is the agencies that are both licensing you now, does anybody have any heartburn here? If you have one license, I'm all about the idea of this thing, trust me. But I just, what concerns would there be from folks that, like the state, gets all wound up in liabilities and concerns? What are they concerned about, if any? And we can even ask them, or if you know this as well. Rep. Curran.
Representative Curran.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Baker. And first, I want to thank you for your co-authorship of this bill. And I just want to acknowledge the conversation that we had. It took about 15 minutes to a half an hour to talk about a set of bills together. And I just really appreciate working with you on these issues. So as far as I'm aware, there is a bit of concern on the side of DHS. And the notes that I have so far, the concerns seem to be surrounding essentially how are they going to know, how are they going to have this data, and that it seems difficult to manage, which I certainly can appreciate and understand from an operations perspective. But at the same time, without having a solid solution for language that can tackle that, my perspective on this bill as is that we just need folks to be in good communication with each other, and we don't necessarily need to, legislate the heck out of this bill here that's only affecting 14 homes. I think we can all do well at the jobs we already have and communicate effectively to make sure that no data is being missed. I don't see that as having a significant fiscal impact either, as long as people are being transparent with what they're going through as they're transferring the license. Certainly, state and county is still going to have the data on who's operating which license, so I don't have any concerns there. And I'll turn it over to Ken Benz if he has anything to add.
Mr. Benz.
Thank you. There are also some questions about how this works within the restrictions of the moratorium that exists right now. And as I said, we're not adding any capacity. We're not changing anything in terms of the services that are being provided. It's really a change in licensure. And I'm sure that smart people on both sides can figure out how to make this work. We're continuing to get conversations with DHS, and so I think we'll be able to figure this out.
Representative.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. I think the question that has been raised is about the capacity. We're talking about the CRS capacity of 4 compared to the SLF capacity of 6, and the two and how they'll be moved to, you know, we have to open up the moratorium exception to move them to the CRS. So can you talk more about that in terms of the capacity setting in this bill so that SLF can get up to 6 beds?
I think those are some of the administrative details that still have to be worked out. There is a mechanism for CRSs to have exceptions up to 6 beds, and so I think we can figure out a way to help that fit into those parameters.
I think those are things that I think we have to continue having the conversation. I'm hoping that the department will reach out and we'll be able to come up with a solution on that. Any other member discussion? Hearing none or seeing none, for your closing remarks, Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair Noor. Thank you, committee members, again, for the discussion and consideration of House File 3939. I will say I do know that the moratorium is a concern that's been brought up. Again, I don't have concerns as far as the moratorium goes because this doesn't allow for us to open capacity statewide. That's essentially the moratorium, if folks aren't aware. And I also don't, I don't really see the CRS 4-bed exception to be up to the 6-bed for these homes. I really don't see that to be a large concern. I feel that's appropriately addressed in this bill. So that we know it will only pertain to these 14 homes should they decide to convert their license. And I would just say that this bill provides the opportunity for up to 84 Minnesotans to receive the services that they need. And while it's a small impact statewide, it would mean the world for these specific individuals. So I would appreciate support moving forward.
Thank you so much. I'll renew my motion that House File 3939 to be laid over, so the bill is laid over. Thank you so much. The next bill is House File 4203, Chair Pryor. Chair Pryor moves House File 4203 to be laid over. Please introduce your bill and proceed.
Right. Thank you, Chair Noor. So we have before you 4203, which was heard previously in education policy and then advanced here, and we appreciate that. So this is a bill that deals with Medicaid waivers and also a new technology. And what's most exciting about to talk about is the technology itself. The expedited approval of this is what is the gist of the bill, though. So I'm not going to talk too much about the technology because my testifiers will do that. But just to say that what we're looking for is we do have this technology, this innovation, the way really that healthcare should be delivered more in the future, and we want the future to come faster. So this is a way to work with that, to work with our systems as they exist, and get a faster approval. But it's also being set up as a demonstration project so that the data that and the information can be used to inform how this is rolled out going forward from here. So I think that it's a small step forward, but it would have a big impact on people's lives. So I will turn it over to my testifiers after that.
Welcome, Mr. Steve Pontius. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chairman Noor and committee members. It's my pleasure to be before you today. My name is Steve Pontius, and I'm the CEO of HealthyMed. I've been in healthcare for 35 years and have been known as a disruptor. As the founder of MinuteClinic, I learned that one of the ways to provide better care is to work directly with the patient or the client. HealthyMed's founders share this vision as well. HealthyMed is a Minnetonka-based company that is committed to serving all waivered clients in Minnesota. For the first time, clients can see primary care doctors to address their needs and personal medical choices and access behavior health services in days rather than weeks, months, or not at all. In short, HealthyMed has taken a holistic approach to this complex, underserved population by moving them from the highest cost setting of care, the ER, and moving them to the lowest cost setting of care, the home. We bring health equity to this marginalized population and lower their cost of care at the same time. Today, HealthyMed serves over 300 clients in 29 counties in Minnesota and growing. We've reduced ER visits by 50%, improved medication adherence by 61%, and reduced provider missed appointments by 20% for this costly population. While this legislation is not specific to HealthyMed, it focuses on offering waivered clients a technology option which creates access to telemedicine in the home, helps reduce the labor shortage challenges we face in healthcare, helps reduce disparities related to social determinants of health, and lowers taxpayer spends so dollars can be repurposed in other areas of need. With 87,000 waivered clients in Minnesota today, HealthyMed intends to demonstrate significant disruption of the cost curve with a small population of 500 clients. It's important for the committee to understand key aspects of this legislation. Number one, HealthyMed has secured bipartisan and bicameral support. HealthyMed is not requesting funding. We are a home and community-based service provider, and we are not asking for an increase in our rates. This bill aims to allow counties to partner with lead agencies to bring health equity to this population. HealthyMed does not see a need for a fiscal note with this bill. We are happy to work with DHS to provide the data they need in a format that allows them to evaluate cost savings and outcomes for this targeted population. We are also open to adjusting language in this bill to ensure clients that qualify for desired assistive technology services in their home can receive it in a timely fashion. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We have Dr. Abdullah. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor. My name is Dr. Khan Abdullah. I am one of the founders and CEO of Global Health Alliance, which is a nonprofit organization based in Minnesota here. GHA is a nonprofit organization with twofold mission to work locally and globally. We started with our local work with maternal health, with maternal and child health at the beginning, and now we have expanded it to preventative and monitoring chronic conditions. To improve the quality, access, and services in a culturally responsive manner and utilize collaborative model that includes education, training, and system development with individuals in their community in the local healthcare systems. GHA is happy and eager to partner with HealthyMed through Hennepin County Public Health Grant to tackle these disparities and inequalities in healthcare. GHA Global Health Alliance will bring on-the-ground community engagements to meet the needs of this community that we serve, that we're partnering together. The grant will allow us, the organizations, to bring the healthcare services into the homes of Hennepin County Somali population to create awareness and education and training surrounding the available resources and how to access them, specifically the HealthyMed clinic at home services, such as the technology that we are talking about, bringing into their homes, helping them, teaching them, making them understand the technology as people who looks like them, who speaks the same language, who also provides the services in the community and understands them. And as some of us are being providers that have been in the roles of the healthcare ourselves, know that the disparity these folks face is being at home and isolated and not being able to get to their clinics or to their hospitals or whatnot, or even just having another set of eyes or someone that they can reach out to and be able to connect with. So being that bridge that will help facilitate that, the grant partnership allows the clients to receive cultural components at the clinic at home, team members, and them to help them navigate their journey, that create that visual access that we've talked about through their primary care, seeking health, behavioral health, or maternal health. Also will allow providers to be proactive in monitoring these conditions for these populations so that we are not being reactive rather than being proactive at the early stages on. So thank you for listening, and we're hoping to be able to get beyond the Hennepin County for these populations to be able to bridge that.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone in the public who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Kutuza will turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Pryor, for bringing this bill forward. It's
a very intriguing process, I think. So it was fun to learn about. I'm particularly impressed with the 61% increase in medication adherence that has been shown in patients. That's something that my family is dealing with right now with my eldest son, trying to get him to continue taking his medication. And even for us as adults, I think if we're not suffering from a variety of different challenges beyond our control, how hard it can be to remember to take a daily medication. So I think that that's tremendous. And then also really like to see that reduction in treatment, because I know that transportation has been such an issue. And in my district, the Southwest Transit has been trying to partner with local hospitals to get people to their appointments on time. And this is certainly, you know, if they don't leave their home, they don't have to deal with traffic or weather or a variety of other issues. So very neat to learn about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member discussion? Representative Kim.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Pryor, for the bill. I have two questions. So one is more, I was going to highlight a data point that I like too, is the 20% reduction in missed appointments. Wondering, like, so missing appointments is one thing, rescheduling appointments is kind of the next level to that. How successful are you in not only just like reducing the missed appointments, but making sure that they then find their new appointment time? That's my first question, and then I do have a follow-up.
So there's a couple of ways to answer that. If we're talking about clients that we have on our platform today, missed appointments are 1%.
Oh.
So if you're on our platform, the way we wrap our care around you with reminder calls, reminders on your TV that the appointment's coming, if that needs to be rescheduled, we can do that and be flexible around that. But our data today would tell you that it's 1%. We do have to reschedule some of those as well, but we can do that because we're working upstream before the actual visit happens to ensure that we're not wasting nursing time or physician time to be able to have those visits.
Representative Gill.
I think that's great. Thanks. So my next question is more, I sit on a border city. I serve Moorhead, and I know that when it comes to some of this, like, technology, medical support, it matters if you're in the state or out of the state to receive services. Is there any barriers around supporting services if somebody's traveling out of the state to, like, go see family or go see a kid in college? Like, how does the actual location of an individual impact supportive services through this?
Mr. Pontius.
Thank you, Chairman. The answer to that is it depends on a few things. Visits are done through the television today. So if you're not by your television, you can't do that. Nursing outreach, physician outreach, our client engagement specialist outreach can all be done regardless of where you are. Your medication adherence device you can take with you, and it will store that data until you come back and then download it into the system so we can track that as well. So there's a lot of different ways to be able to do that. On our roadmap, technology-wise, it'll be an app on your phone, and you'll be able to do it that way.
Representative Hill.
No more questions. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you. Welcome back. It's good to see you again. Again, I'm very supportive of the bill. The question I have, though, as a business guy and part of this, you know, investment that we make with these clients is that TV. The TV doesn't, you know, break down usually anytime soon. And how do you handle recycling those things? If a client is there for 2-3 years, still working in good order, how do you kind of either recycle? How does the funding of this then either get modified a bit or changed, or does it? Just because, again, we have to see long term. Our best use of our dollars. How does that work with recycling, if you could, sir?
Mr. Pontius.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Baker, the answer to that is when a client leaves us, whether that be through hospitalization or they move out of state or pass away, our installation team goes in and recoups all of those products, TV, RPM devices, brings those back in-house, they're thoroughly tested, put back on the shelf, and they're redeployed.
Ready to go.
Yep.
Thank you.
Any other member discussion? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Chair Pryor?
just to briefly say thank you for hearing this bill and advancing it. I hope it gets serious consideration. It has a lot of support, and I think it will be a strong step forward for Minnesota.
With that, Chair Pryor renews her motion that House File 4203 to be laid over. The bill is laid over. So thank you so much. The final bill on the list is House File 4220. Representative Lee, welcome to the committee, and I can see you are adhering to the traditions of first hearing in any committee that you provide treats, although I may not have any today, but yeah.
I know, apologies, Chair, and
I'll save some for
maybe. Yes, please take a box home for after sundown.
Appreciate that. So I'll move that House File 4220 to be re-referred to the Commerce Committee. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce the bill while people are having a treat so we can actually chew gum and continue.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we have a compressed timeline today, so I appreciate you and the committee's indulgence for taking time to hear House File 4220. Members, as you may know, in 2019, the legislature passed an historic assisted living licensure law, which made Minnesota the last state in the country to license assisted living facilities. I guess this is my second bill trying to bring Minnesota from last to first. And so honored that I'm working with folks who, I don't know, Sean, if you want to come down and just sit with us. Have been working diligently to ensure that we protect some of our most vulnerable Minnesotans. This law passed in 2019 gave residents critical consumer protections with, however, two exempted settings. The first is receiving money from HUD for housing, and the second is receiving LIHTC, or what we know as low-income housing tax credits. And note that both of these provide same or similar services, but are still exempted. Initially, the concern for the exemption was that federal funding may be jeopardized if forced to be licensed. However, a report in 2022 by DHS workgroups showed that residents in these exempted settings receive less protections than those in assisted living. Most notably, the workgroups found that there's no legal reason why residents in these two settings should not receive the same or similar consumer protections as their peers in assisted living. This disparity has led to real consequences. Some of you may recall that in July, dozens of residents living in a LIHTC facility in Bemidji were forced to leave a dangerous building. However, there were absolutely no obligations on the provider to assist with finding a new safe place to live, and there were no transfer plans for residents who critically needed them. In your packet is a letter from Lisa Papp Richards, a volunteer who helped relocate some of those residents impacted. She describes the chaotic aftermath. Vulnerable adults without safe places to go and no clear path to enforce, appeal, or challenge what happened to them. Now, this bill fixes the current disparity by providing residents in HUD and LIHTC facilities similar protections, such as freedom from retaliation, freedom from arbitrary discharge, due process, and appeal rights upon termination from the facility. You've also probably seen in your packets letters of opposition to this bill. I want to note to the members on the committee that I've talked to concerned members of the provider community, and we continue to have conversations. We believe that I think there should also be an amendment to this. So with the amendment and continued conversations, most of the concerns should be addressed.
So do you want to move the A2 amendment now?
Sure.
So you can add
we can do that.
So I'll move A2 amendment for consideration. Can you please explain the A2 amendment?
Yes, so this is actually a really good place to talk about the amendment because we've heard significant feedback from providers and other folks. So originally the bill was introduced, as if you might note, would have forced HUD facilities to become licensed. The amendment, the larger piece, of the amendment just draws in folks in HUD facilities and LIHTC facilities to just give those residents enhanced protections. So that's the big change. And that is the version of the bill that we are presenting and I hope will advance to the Commerce Committee.
Any discussion on the A2 amendment, members? Seeing none, All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The A2 amendment is now adopted. To your bill as amended, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the idea today is to use this bill as amended to solve this unfair system where residents of facilities subsidized by federal government money continue to have fewer rights than those living in private assisted living. And I mean, I should note that, you know, these individuals are living in HUD and LIHTC settings because they are, you know, exceptionally relatively more vulnerable. And so I'm going to turn it to my testifiers to elaborate on how the bill works exactly and why it's so important.
Mr. Burke, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Noor, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Sean Burke. I'm with O'Connell Consulting here on behalf of the Minnesota Elder Justice Center, and also speaking on behalf of a coalition of resident and consumer advocates. And I just want to take a couple of minutes to briefly explain exactly what this bill as amended is doing and what it's not doing. So in our current assisted living statute, 144G, there are types of settings that are similar to assisted living, but they receive federal funding for their housing. And so we commonly refer to these as exempt settings because they're exempt from licensure. And this bill addresses and increases consumer protections for the residents in these exempt settings. As amended, want to be clear, this bill is not making any of those settings get licensed, but it is bringing parity for the consumers and the residents in those settings similar to those who live in assisted living. So how does it work? Under current law already, residents in exempt settings have some protections, really the bare minimum, and those are found in a consumer protection statute that's 325F.722. These protections have no teeth or mechanism of enforcement, and this bill seeks to change that. Again, many of the residents in these settings are in the same exact or similar type of positions as assisted living residents, group home residents, and nursing home residents. But under current law, for example, they only get 10 days notice if they receive home care for termination of services. So this bill is enhancing the protections under 325F.722. The guts of this bill are really found at sections 7 through 11. And taken together, they now allow residents in exempt settings to have an enforcement mechanism. They can appeal a termination of their services or their housing, and they can go to an administrative law judge if they disagree. This is what residents in assisted living and nursing homes can do now. Right now, these residents can only be taken to housing court, and they have no affirmative defenses to appeal a termination. Furthermore, if they do have to move or they agree to move, right now there's no obligation on exempt setting providers to help them go find a new safe place to live. This bill changes that. And as Representative Lee mentioned, there's no affirmative obligation on the provider to protect residents and help them find a place if they have to shut down. So this bill is not making exempt settings get licensed, but it is bringing long-needed parity in consumer protections. As for some of the concerns you may hear, we're working to address those. The use of the term assisted living in this bill is not necessary, and we can find new technical language to make sure that we get it right. Furthermore, this bill does call for one contract, and that also doesn't have to be the case. We can find language to make sure that both contracts are tweaked so that, again, residents in these exempt settings can have appeal rights and be protected. What we don't want, however, is residents in these settings who don't receive any services. This bill is only providing enhanced protections. And so even if you're not getting services, those residents should get the same rights just as they do in assisted living. I now want to turn it over to another testifier who has a personal story to exemplify why this is so important. And thanks again for your time.
Thank you so much, Sasha. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Good afternoon. My name is Sasha Rabakina, and I want to start off by saying thank you for letting me stand before you and share my grandma's story with you all. And then I do want to share a photo of my grandma. This is her and her first great-grandbaby, so my daughter that was just born a couple of months ago. So in 2020, my grandma moved to a HUD-subsidized locked memory care facility. She can hardly recall faces and requires full assistance with her cares. In this facility, my grandma has experienced numerous falls, unexplained injuries, and was even found lying in her own stool and urine for several hours. In September, she was placed on one-to-one staffing needs for loss of inhibitions, and this is a normal and expected part of the dementia progression. The facility executed this without a physician's order, no documented progress notes, no complaints from staff. And due to my grandma's increased need for supervision, the facility sent a letter with a 10-day notice of termination of services. And basically what this means is her services would be terminated, but she could still live at the facility. But that means nobody would take care of her. Nobody would bathe her, clean her, change her diaper, or keep her safe. And due to the current state statutes, my grandma had minimal rights or protection against this. She was not provided with community resources. She received minimal support in finding a safe facility. She was not able to appeal the termination. And despite the support we received from the Office of Ombudsman, there was nothing we could do. As a nurse, I knew that what was happening with my grandma was unethical and wrong. This is a facility that continues to advertise as an assisted living and memory care facility and provides the same services as a licensed facility would, but it does not uphold the ethical standards or principles of avoiding harm and promoting dignity and respect in our vulnerable adults. Unfortunately, this is a reality for many families, not only fearing the safety of our loved ones, but also navigating the physical, emotional, and the financial burden associated with the current termination laws. So it is with a heavy heart that the same woman who gave so selflessly was the one mistreated and neglected in a facility that was meant to provide her with care, comfort, and security. And for this reason, I sit here to help you hear me. Let's demand better standards for elder care facilities. Let's advocate and work together to employ the legal protections to safeguard the well-being of older adults. This is your grandma, your grandpa, your mom, your dad, or anyone else that you care and that means the world to you. And I am sharing my grandma's hardship to start a crucial conversation and to advocate for those that have given so much to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rebecca, for your testimony and also sharing your story. We're sorry to what happened to your grandmother.
Thank you.
The next person we have on the list is Mr. Berg. Josh Berg, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Josh Berg. I am with a nonprofit based here in St. Paul called Accessible Space, Inc., that provides affordable, accessible housing throughout Minnesota and 30-ish other states. All of our settings are HUD-subsidized affordable housing settings. Here in Minnesota, we offer supports in several of these settings, including integrated community supports, community residential services, and customized living services. As the language in 144G is currently written, all ASI settings are exempt from the AL licensure laws that went into effect a few years ago. I had the pleasure of being a part of these discussions prior to the passage of the assisted living licensure that ended up ensuring that these exemptions to this licensure included HUD-subsidized settings such as ours until or if appropriate alternative licensing paths were created. This is why I'm here today. Our goal over the years has been to find and obtain the appropriate licensure for the services we provide and to be able to meet the needs of the individuals we have the privilege of supporting. As I mentioned in previous committee hearings and discussions with some of you, I would love nothing more than to find a home for our three exempt customized living settings and get them under 245D. However, due to the restrictions on size, capacity related to CRS settings, and some of the physical setting requirements related to ICS settings, these three homes are stuck providing customized living services with an MDH comprehensive home care license. I am hopeful this bill, along with the other 144G cleanup bills likely to be heard this session, while not their main intent, will spark the conversation once again. And I would welcome any conversations with any of you, department folks, ARM, RPAM, and imperative staff and members and advocates to find the most appropriate paths to actual licensure. Now to the bill in front of us. While I completely agree with the why behind the bill and the general intent, as the bill currently sits, even with the amendment, there are still some concerns with several of the components addressed. Although Sean, fellow Creighton Blue Jay and number 8 in the nation, might I add, spoke to some of these concerns, and I am very confident that we'll work with the author to address many of them. The idea of a combined contract simply will not work within the HUD MHFA frameworks, and I recommend ongoing discussions with agency staff and HUD experts, both of which I am not. And the broad use and insertion of the term assisted living to other services is problematic on a variety of levels. Assisted living has historically been a protected title term, and those of us not providing these services have scrubbed it from all of our documents, marketing materials, websites, etc. This would now blur those lines completely, likely causing additional confusion and misunderstanding from individuals receiving services, their families, and the general public. And something to keep an eye on is that Chair Wicklund has a bill moving in the Senate that statutorily restricts its use, and that's Senate File 4573. As I said, I appreciate the intent and the goals of this bill. Do I think service terminations under 144A need more than 10-day notice? 100%. Do I think that we should include protections related to handling residents' finances and property? No-brainer. Do I think that there could be better way to do appeals, coordinated moves, and transfers and planned closures? Yep, absolutely. And should it be clear, retaliation of any kind will not be tolerated, without hesitation. There are several good pieces to this legislation and reflect the great intent of the individuals working on this language. I appreciate Rep. Lee and these advocates for including me and some of our colleagues in these discussions, and I look forward to continuing to work with them to find a path for this to move forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. The next person is Phoebe Tripp. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello. Hi, everyone. I'm Phoebe Trepp, Executive Director at Clare Housing, she, her pronouns, and so happy to be here. Thanks, Chair. Today happens to be HIV Day on the Hill, so I'm excited to be here in multiple capacities. Good afternoon, Chair Noor and other members of the committee. At Clare Housing, we provide permanent supportive housing to end homelessness for people living with HIV. Our clients are ages 18 to 80, plus their kids and partners. We provide effective care for people living with HIV, including nursing services and end-of-life care. One of the services we provide is 24/7 customized living to people with disabilities. Roughly 15% of our clients receive these services. Our clients choose if they want to live at Clare, if they want services, and if they want us or an outside provider to come in and provide those services. They live in their own private apartments. We have on-site nursing and healthcare staff who see clients daily. We are an exempt setting referenced in this bill under Exemption 10. We are not an assisted living facility or an assisted living provider. We are a low-income apartment building with nursing and healthcare on-site. Our clients do have leases, which in some ways are different protections, not necessarily less protections. Our concern with this bill has been referenced. There's some work being done on the language to help mediate the concerns, but it's really with the language saying that we are a setting in which assisted living services are provided and requiring us to have a subsidized assisted living contract. We're not assisted living, which is terminology we feel should be specifically used for assisted living providers to help provide clarity to clients and their families. Assisted living is a classification that differs from our care model. This language puts our services in jeopardy due to tax credit regulations. Going back to that 2022 report that was done, there was lengthy research by DHS and their partners to produce a report on what the actual limitations were, and what they found is that interpretations of IRS code, which not an expert, indicate an assisted living facility would likely be considered a healthcare facility, and that many MHFA funding mechanisms rely on IRS tax credits, which includes Clare Housing, which are not approved for use to develop healthcare facilities. So it's in direct contradiction of what we're able to do in the building. I do recognize that there was a terrible problem with a HUD-funded building in Bemidji this past year. The bill, unfortunately, does nothing to address the issue of an unexpected, dangerous infrastructure problem. This bill would not stop a future public health inspector from closing a dangerous building, whether it was providing customized living, assisted living, or no services at all. So in terms of protections, we also welcome them. We would be happy with the things that
what's just mentioned by Josh, the former testifier, but also the things in this bill. We are already subject to the current Home Care Bill of Rights, statutes governing home care services, and 504B housing protections for renters. We're legally bound to all eviction and termination protections, so in our case, a 10-day eviction does not exist. Anyone with a lease would have to go through an actual eviction process, which usually in our case takes 90 days at minimum. If this committee is interested in duplicating that language of protections, we are happy to do that without the language that's currently written into this bill. We're troubled by the deepening complexity and burden that this bill creates without helping our clients. Our clients are dealing with how to manage diabetes, COPD, HIV, and other complex issues amidst a meth and fentanyl crisis, a bare bones public safety sector, and surging mental health concerns. We really hope that we can get to a place where we feel we can still operate our building, provide services to people in need, and really cover the protections that that you'd like to see added to our licensure. We're requesting that either the language is adjusted or that the bill is held off until we can show that it would provide something new and would allow us to continue to provide life-saving housing to our clients. So thank you so much for letting me talk, and thanks for those of you who are meeting with people about HIV Day on the Hill.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony. The next person that I have is Kimberly Knight. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Kimberly Knight, and I'm here to testify on the behalf of this bill. I'm the director of aging at the Wilder Foundation, located here in St. Paul. I've worked in healthcare for over 20 years, with the last 10 years being in healthcare management in both the private and nonprofit sector. I also hold an assisted living licensure as I ran assisted living, and so I'm very familiar with its laws and its leasing and the protections. But I'm here today to testify in opposition to House File 4220. Wilder has two customized living programs located in St. Paul, public high-rises. We provide medication administration, activities of daily living, and opportunities for social interaction for those who are in need. Wilder has supported seniors and vulnerable adults in these buildings for over 30 years. By being allowed to support, we have been helping residents stay in their home semi-independently with their dignity intact. Our longest-standing resident, Mrs. Rare, has been supported by the Wilder, our longest current resident, rather, for the last 16 years. In an exempt setting, we do provide assisted living-like services to those who are in need. And then we do have some residents that do not as well. While I appreciate the amendment removing the requirement to obtain an assisted living license for most of us, the remainder of the bill still holds in an unreasonable expectation of process and contract requirements that would be layered on top of what we are already required to do. Although the amendment will provide more time for residents to find new placement if needed, it also opens up other challenges. For example, when a resident needs a higher level of care than customized living can provide, the resident will be allowed to remain in their home in unsafe medical conditions longer than they should be. When residents present with decline and need a higher level of care, our duty is to support the resident through its process by finding proper care and new placement. And I assure you, it takes more than 10 days, although that is the law. Anybody that's providing care ethically, 10 days is never enough. So I just want to make that clear that I don't like the 10-year language, because realistic, if you work in this field, you know you can't find someone placement in 10 days. In addition, Wilder also to keep residents in their home. As you know, it's a huge nonprofit. So often when residents are coming up towards eviction for payment issues or other issues, I also source funding through our corporation to help those residents pay the bill to stay in their home. So there's a lot that we don't get to speak about that we do that is not necessarily all the way clear. Most of us run our customized living programs effectively and efficiently without the assisted living licensure in place just by a code of ethics that we follow as medical professionals. I'm concerned that having this extended time when we get in a situation with a resident that needs a higher level of care due to a rapid decline, it will be harder to get residents moved on to that higher level of care. And then that places our healthcare professionals into providing care that's not in their scope because we're not going to just stop providing care in 10 days because we are aware that we are it for a lot of people. I'd like to piggyback off what Phoebe said. What happened in Bemidji was very, very tragic and very wrong and unethical. Sadly, it's my first time of hearing something like that happening because anyone in our practice should know better and they should do better. No one deserved to be displaced in that manner and we should have pulled together, went out to Bemidji and helped people. At the same time, respecting the differences of what other people need in the same time. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you so much, Ms. Knight, for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wanted to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member discussions? Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I think that this is an important kind of a bill that we really need to, you know, understand the protections that we need to provide our citizens of Minnesota. I think that consumer protection is certainly a paramount. Sounds like you're attempting to do some things with an amendment. Doesn't sound like we're there yet, you know, hearing some of the comments. My concern, again, really focusing on making sure we still have these homes available. We don't lose them or they start shuttering their doors because the rules of Minnesota get more complicated and there's different levels of this type of a service. You know, we do this a lot with my friend Representative Fisher and Representative Frederick, and we sometimes have to park a bill and keep working on it before it moves forward. Mm-hmm. You've got to, I know this has got other stops to make, I believe, this bill. Yep. And it sounds like it still needs that cohesiveness, and you got to find some peace in the valley. Have you met yet with the other folks too that are having some of the heartburn here personally? And can you tell me what your plan is to keep moving this forward, possibly?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, absolutely. So just the way it works, we have to make a couple of committee deadlines. This has to go to the Commerce Committee because we are touching their jurisdiction, and so. Like I said, it continues to be a work in progress. We have met with everybody who's reached out, and if not, you know, we have pending appointments. But I'm pretty sure we've met with everyone who's reached out already with concerns or feedback. So, yeah, definitely want to just emphasize the point that we don't want these really critical facilities to shut down. I think Clare Housing is the only facility in the state that receives HOPWA funding from the federal government, right? And so we want to make sure that you know, our Minnesotans with HIV/AIDS continue to have a place where they can receive care.
Representative,
thank you. I think you know, I'd like to support a bill like this, but I certainly have hesitancy to do that if we don't have the stakeholders on board. So I hope that that can find where they can say they can support this. It is really unfortunate what we heard from Grandma. That was not necessary, and it's not what we want to hear. But I do hope that we we can find better ways of making this bill better as it moves along. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee. And this may be a question for some of your testifiers. I'm not sure who, and I do apologize because customized living is not kind of my wheelhouse, and so I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So I heard several of your testifiers talk about when someone's level of care is too much to remain in the setting that they're in. And then I heard people talk about providers sharing or having to do things that are outside of their scope. And I heard people talk about how it takes more than 10 days. And so in this committee, we've heard a lot about sort of the struggles that our hospital system is having when people get discharged with nowhere else to go. And so I'm a little concerned because if people can't provide the care, I heard a lot of conflicting sort of things about what was happening. So people only get 10 days, and your bill changes it to 15?
Representative Lee or Mr. Burke?
Yeah, I'm going to let Mr. Burke answer this, but I will say definitely open to more than 10 days.
Sean Burke, Chair Noor, Representative Hicks. Yeah, what this bill does is it borrows the current appeals framework that is now operating and has been operating well for the last 2 years in assisted living. And the way that appeals framework works is if the provider believes they can no longer provide the care, they will issue a termination notice, and then a series of consumer protections kick in, the first of which is actually a meeting for the family and the resident and the care team to discuss what's actually going on. And sometimes the issue is, let's just put, mom is wandering a lot, let's put a doorbell on the door to quell the concern. Sometimes the issue is not solved there, and so the facility needs to proceed with the termination. At that point, the family and the resident has a choice. They can continue on that termination, or if they feel that termination is in error, or that there could be more care provided, they could work it out, maybe they could bring in their own care team. They can appeal to an administrative law judge, not to a housing court. And we know from the administrative law judges that they've received somewhere between 100 and 150 of these appeals over the last 2 years. Only two of those cases they report have actually ever gone to the actual hearing. Because what's happening in that time is the care team and the family are continuing to talk about how to resolve the situation. And many times what happens is the individual finds a safe location and a soft landing because the care team is getting involved, the family's getting involved. And unlike the testimony you heard, it's not just a quick 10-day notice, which is current home care law. So we want to borrow that framework that we think is working well in assisted living and bring it over to the residents who are in very similar situation. It's just that the housing funding where they're living comes from the federal government. That's the main difference.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for helping me better understand those differences. I guess we've heard just so much in this committee about the hospital decompression issues, and we've heard so many times about how they're not like magic beds somewhere, and that everybody is just really struggling, care coordinators, county social workers, county case managers, across the sector for all different types of folks, children, adults, our elderly, that finding somewhere to go has just been really challenging and people are getting stuck. And so personally, I think making sure we give people more time than 15 days, I mean, that's like depending on what day that happens, that's maybe like what, 8 working days where you might be able to like reach somebody and make a referral. I guess I'm a little concerned that with all the crises that we've heard about space, that is even just not a lot of time for a worker or a family to find somewhere. So that was just me trying to understand sort of how these timelines would work. What happens at the end of the 10 days if the family can't find somewhere? Where are folks going?
Briefly, Mr. Beck, and then we'll go to Representative Lesnicka.
Chair Noor, Representative Hicks. So the 10-day notice is a termination of services. So under current law, a the service provider can give the 10-day notice and then stop providing services. And I think that's what you heard. And what that effectively does is when you live in a place where your services are the housing's dependent on the services, yeah, you might not be evicted, but if they are not giving you services anymore, you can't really live there anymore. And so what happens is what you heard. People scramble. They go couch surf. They're kind of desperate. And again, the 15 days is borrowed from assisted living. And it provides a little bit more protection than people have now. And it also, the 15 days is also coupled with this appeal rights so that things slow down a little bit and so that there is a safe kind of smooth, orderly transition. That's what this bill is attempting to do because right now we don't have that under the 10-day notice.
Okay. Thank you for indulging me, Chair.
I think Representative Zillesmaker.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Lee. I understand the intent of what this is. Although I have not ran, I've been a nursing home administrator and worked in assisted living, which is 144G, and then federal. So this is different. And I think that's the difference that's hard for people to understand. These HUD buildings are very, the use is different throughout the state in the communities. And so it was a great model for affordable housing. And the building is one part of this, and then the services are a whole other part. So the intent was always to give people choice, choice to have the services they want. You know, if you're living in your home, or you're living in an apartment, or you're living in a HUD building, there's individual choice on receiving services or not receiving services. For those that operate nursing homes and assisted livings and group homes, those type of models, that's more of a 24-hour staffed facility with a completely different focus model. To the family member who testified, I mean, I agree, there should be transparency, and that comes down to, you know, I think my concern is paintbrushing an industry when you have isolated cases. If there's bad players that operate outside the scope of traditional ethical conduct that I see going on across the state, the risks of what we will create sometimes are more elevated. And that is what I think this bill needs, is some more work, because the reality is that if somebody's in a facility, in a building, receiving services that are outside the scope, and they can't provide that, that is what's considered neglect in a healthcare world. So they're trying to coordinate services. You do not know when the person is all of a sudden having a significant change of condition, whether it's 10 days or 15 days. If the needs of the person that is aging transcends to something that is not safe, that is a word called neglect in a healthcare world. And so providers, the ethical providers that I've known my entire life, that's what they're trying to coordinate. The problem is, to Representative Hicks' point, there are no beds. And so what is the solution ends up being 911. And so when coordination doesn't happen, it's another person held in the hospital system. And that's what I fear on this. I mean, part of this whole deal here is we're trying to let people stay in the choice they choose. In the models of the HUD that typically are in place that I've seen, this scenario that was talked about today shouldn't happen to the person who had their grandma. And, you know, I mean, there should be a transparent thing of what you do and the scope. And that's what I'm familiar with seeing, because people live in these HUD buildings with all various needs. There could be 75 independent and 5 people that get services from family, from contracted services, and that's their right. And you also have the right to make a bad decision or no decision. And so I think it's a very slippery slope on this. And I don't know what the fiscal note of this is, the implications of that, but I would love to work with you. I know what the intent is. I know what you're trying to accomplish. I just think that this is an onion with a lot of layers, that it's complicated. So I would suggest that we just hit the pause a little bit and get it right. Thank you.
We're a little bit past time, so I will give you a brief closing remarks, Representative Lee, and then we'll go to the vote on the bill.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a request up for the fiscal note. We believe there is a small, if at all, cost, and so we'll chat more about that when we get to the next stop. I know we don't have a lot of time, so just want to close us by saying I think we share a lot of the same core principles. I know, you know, we would very much like to advance House File 4220 to the Commerce Committee and keep working on it. We hear the feedback from the advocates, and we'll continue to work with them and appreciate the interest from Rep. Baker and Rep. Zalesnikar and also Rep. Hicks. I know we've had some conversations about this, so I know we want to move forward because housing courts just aren't working for these people. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. I'll renew my motion that House File 4220 as amended to be re-referred to Commerce Committee. With that, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and you are on your way to the Commerce Committee. Members, I think we have been shown how, when you've got your first time a bill here, thank you to Representative Lee. So next time, remember that. We don't have any other agenda items before us. We now adjourn.